Welcome back to Bad Gay Movies, episode 182. I am Bill, as always. To those of you who finished Brittany's memoir, thank you for now putting down Barbara's memoir in order to listen to today's show. Is that even out yet? I am not sure. I can't wait. I hope 900 of the 1,000 pages are just her telling us how much she loves McConnell's ice cream. This episode this week is one of my favorites that we recorded this season, and it takes me back to a movie that I had not watched in a long time that I used to love. It also brings us back one of our favorite guests, the great Brian Francis, author, playwright. You'll find out all about what he's been up to on the episode. I should also mention that I saw The Holdovers, and awards season is fully in swing. I absolutely adored it. If you haven't seen it, go out and catch it. And visit us on the web, badgaymovies.com. Write to us, badgaymovies2013@gmail.com. Follow us on the socials, Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, Instagram. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the show.
Hollywood, California, the San Francisco of Los Angeles.
There's not a single film in the cinema canon that paints a portrait of a gay man that any of us would aspire to be. Can you imagine if they made a film about us, our group of friends?
I know they're my friends. I just don't know if I can trust any of them, especially when it comes to men.
You must be Ennis.
That's Dennis. Somebody ate the D.
Clearly, without them, my life would be a lot less fun.
Welcome to Bad Gay Movies. I am your co-host, Bill Antoniou, and with me is...
Daniel Krolik.
Hello, Daniel. How are you?
I'm well. I'm happy to be here.
And that's our opening show banter.
Yeah.
All right.
Did you believe that when I told you that I was happy to be here?
I never do.
Did that come off as believable?
No. As we always know, Daniel can never be here in spirit, so he's always here in person.
And I'm never happy to be anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. we are so thrilled to have our returning guest today. He hasn't been on the show in a few years. By the way, I have to point out both of my co-hosts today have Wikipedia pages, and I'm not happy about this at all because
I just got one.
I'm not in there. This is very disappointing. Anyway, congratulations, Daniel. You're on the unpeer reviewed web. Anyway,
and I just saw our guest at the Wikipedia members only reunion night.
Fine, whatever. I don't want to know. I know that it's not fun, so I don't care. Okay.
The cheese cubes are to die for.
Yeah, they make you line up. No, they make you line up for food, for sure. It's buffet, and they make you line up, and it takes forever. I fully believe it.
So fully, before we introduce our distinguished guest, when we were just nominated for a Dora Award for Gay for Pay, and we went to the Dora nominee toast, and Curtis and I were in line at for the charcuterie table, and who fully elbowed right in front of us, but one Mr. Adam Egoyan.
Amazing.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
That doesn't surprise me.
He could not wait for those.
Show up at Cinematheque. He would come in just as the lights were going down, and he would have the same spot. So I think he made someone hold a seat for him, and he would always show up right as the movie was starting.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy that Adam Egoyan got his charcuterie and cheese cubes.
And I see him and his wife wandering all over the city all the time. Greg and I drove by them wandering Queen Street not long ago, and Greg was so excited because he'd never seen them in the wild before. Anyway, that's not the point. We need to introduce our guest because, quite frankly, he is so accomplished, I'm amazed he even talks to me. So I'm just going to hope that our friendship lasts at least the length of this show. We have the marvelous Brian Francis with us today. He's the author of Fruit, which was a Canada Reed selection.
So good.
Natural Order. I've never read any of his stuff. I don't have time. Natural Order, Break in Case of Emergency. He wrote the play Box 4901, which he was promoting last time he was here, which Daniel Krolik was in. And wrote the novel version, Missed Connection, a memoir in Letters Never Sent. That's correct, right? I got that right.
That's correct. Yep.
Brian, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me back. I'm excited to be here to talk about Bad Gay Movies.
Yes. And today's film is one that you selected, and I'm so glad you did. I hadn't watched this movie in a very, very long time.
I hadn't either.
And I'm so curious, first of all, to ask you why you picked it.
Well, I was, okay, so I admit I was a bit mistaken with this movie, because in my head, this was like a mid to early 90s movie that I watched in my sort of early 20s when I was kind of coming out. And there was this kind of surge of like those movies that were sort of these gay movies that felt like they were trying to be mainstream. And I listened to the your last podcast, Bill, about Mambo Italiano, and how that was kind of like, there was a moment in time where it felt like, you know, you were going to kind of crack through like the mainstream, like these gay movies were going to kind of, if you could find the right mixture, you could kind of appeal to the straight audiences, but also you could kind of find some validation or recognition of your own life, you know, your own, you know, your own chaos and whatever. So in my mind, The Broken Hearts Club was kind of one of those movies that was like, I think I saw this in my early 20s. I think I kind of liked it, but I think it was kind of bad. And I think I want to go back and revisit it. So when you asked about a movie, I thought, okay, let's go back and revisit this. But it was made in 2000. So then I was kind of like, it screwed with my head a little bit, because I was like, wait a minute. So I would have seen this in my late 20s, I guess, probably at a theater. Maybe I did it, rented it on a VHS. I it messed with me a little bit, because I was like, I had an idea of this movie in my head and when I saw it and sort of the circumstances. And then when I found out the year, I was like, maybe I don't know my own life. Maybe I don't know who I am anymore.
No, because a gay man at 29 is the emotional maturity of like a 14-year-old girl. So you were still young.
Well, hence the movie, right? At least I was in line with the movie, right?
And you were essentially the ages of the characters in the movie. If you were in your early 20s.
Yeah. Yes, that's true.
It's hard to tell. They all have a kind of murky adulthood age to me. Because they're all played by straight guys who drink too much. So they're probably 25, but they look a lot older.
And it's still, and 2000 still, fashion-wise, still had very much of a 1990s hangover. Those jeans are Jesus. So gigantic.
So huge. And at the end of his surprise party, they're all wearing beige shirts. They say surprise, and it's the same guy over and over again in the whole room.
It really reminded me of a million years ago when we reviewed The Object of My Affection with Jennifer Aniston and Paul Rudd. Yeah. And Paul Rudd would be like, look at that hot guy over there. But you couldn't tell because everybody was wearing these boxy shoulder padded.
Yes.
What stood out for me though with this movie, and I never did this fashion trend, and I kind of, I was not sure whether or not this was a gay thing or not, but the necklaces.
So many necklaces.
Like these, but the wooden beads or the coral beads of like, I don't think I know I didn't wear those necklaces.
It seemed like
it was kind of a very straight thing. And I was like, do you remember wearing those kind of necklaces in the 2000s, late 90s?
I don't. I associate those necklaces with Sugar Ray.
Right.
Yes. Yes.
And I thought maybe it's a California thing. According to the trivia, it's something that the boys in the movie all decided they needed to do. And so they all went out and bought necklaces. And it's just like, did you ask your gay friends?
And it's funny because the two gay actors in the movie, John Mahoney and Billy Porter, are not wearing those necklaces.
Yeah.
Yeah.
John Mahoney's not official, by the way, just in case anyone from his family decides to sue us. It's alleged.
Really?
He never officially came out, as far as I know.
Well, that was the thing, because I always had an impression that he was. I don't know where I heard it. I don't know. I just remember the guy from Frasier was like, you know, whatever. And then when I went on, when I was looking into the movie and on his Wikipedia page, there was no mention of it. So then I was like, did I imagine this? Or how did I ever opinion about it?
It's not official. Okay. It's one of those things where we just know. Same with Sherman Helmsley, actually. Yeah.
I also thought Sherman Helmsley was official.
Yeah.
Not really? Official. Or I thought Sherman Hemsley was bi.
Maybe. I don't know. Again, not official. As far as I know, people in the know that he was living with a man when he died. But
George Jefferson?
Yeah, but never came out or anything like that. Same with John Mahoney.
Wow, I have never heard that one before.
John Mahoney is only 60 years old when he makes this movie. I just want to point that out.
He doesn't do very good drag either, but I'm sure we'll get to that.
No, he looks like he runs a motel in the Goonies when he puts on the wig. And I know that was the point. But it's...
Although he is my personal MVP of this movie, because he does food prep in his restaurant while he's smoking a cigar.
Well, there's that. It's also wonderful. I mean, he's truly one of my favorite ever actors. The performance on Frasier was like gold every time. He was so good on that show. He's so good in this movie. He delivers my favorite line when he says that thing about, you know, everyone can't be straight. Everyone can't be beautiful. Some of us are just gay and average, and we're the strongest. It's so I don't know that it's the wisest line ever written, but he makes you feel like it is the way he delivers it with such sincerity.
And he somehow, as an audience member, I had no trouble believing that this much older gentleman was hanging out with this group of 20-somethings and 30-somethings.
Yeah.
Like, it felt like an organic connection to me, the fact that he was hanging out with these much younger men.
Yeah, he has a self-satisfied comfort with the fact that he's kind of a mentor, but he also keeps his nose out of their business. He sort of lets them do their foolishness because he has no illusions about the fact that they're not really interested in anything he has to say about anything, and that it's just comfortable, basically.
I still take issue with the fact that none of them knew the name of his partner. Like, it was the man in purple or whatever. Yeah. Like, it seemed to be the... And then even when... And spoiler alert ahead, but even at the funeral...
Yeah.
How do they bring a baby grand piano to a cemetery?
Like, it was...
we can talk about that later, but it was just like, what the hell?
I haven't been able to think of anything else since I rewatched that scene last night.
Did you see this movie back in the day, Daniel?
I saw this movie within months of coming out. I rented it at Queen Video. Yeah. I was living with a couple of friends in the East End. And within months of sort of coming out to my friends who were nonplussed, who were non-surprised, of going to my first gay bar, I went to Queen Video and rented this movie in the hopes that Dean Cain would have some sort of a sex scene or a shirtless scene.
He's already past his prime in this movie. I'm sorry to say it. I know it sounds terribly shallow of me, but he's not like...
This is only a couple years after Lois and Clark. It's not that much gone. It's
very shocking to me that he's in this movie, given how we know Dean Cain to be now. Like, he's had quite the trajectory, taking Brooke Shields' virginity, starring as Superman, being super hot, and then all of a sudden becoming this like super conservative. Now he's in like Christian movies and stuff. It's quite the journey. And he did this movie against advice from his agents. Like, he really, really wanted to do this movie. I'm sure they all did, because I'm sure that they were all handed the script in a world that had just started watching Will and Grace. So like the culture hadn't quite shifted around that show yet. And it didn't become cool to be in this kind of material.
I guess this movie is higher profile, but I get, and even though I've never seen it, this is only a year or two after It's My Party, right?
Yes, which
was the one with Gregory Harrison.
Yeah, but that's like a very small movie that nobody saw. I mean, while as this one, the trivia I remember reading when it first came out, I remember in a magazine saying it's the first studio movie featuring all gay men since The Boys in the Band, even though, as far as I can tell, it's not a studio movie. It's made by an independent company and then released by Sony Pictures Classics, which is not a big studio. But despite being very dear to my heart. But I saw this at the Carlton, and I very distinctly remember the night I saw it. I saw it with my friend Charlotte. It was one of those just lovely... I think it came out in like September. So it was like a lovely evening. And we got the last two seats in the theater at the Carlton, which, as you remember,
teeny tiny,
but it was packed.
There was two other people there.
Yeah. Well, it was absolutely packed. It was actually before the reno, so there were more seats in there than there are now.
I don't remember that.
It was packed, and everyone was screaming laughing from the opening scene until the end. We all had such a marvelous time, and I always had a wonderful feeling about this movie ever since then. I saw it a few times on video. So that for all its flaws, it's very funny and pleasant. And something I find very interesting is when I was looking up the Wikipedia page, because I do deep research as well.
Wikipedia at Brian Francis, and after you Wikipedia at Daniel Krolik. Yes.
Which I found because you're mentioned on his page. Anyway, whatever. It's fine. I'm popular enough. It's fine. So many of the reviews of this film that were positive kept emphasizing, isn't it nice to see a movie where gay men are normal? Everyone keeps saying that about this movie.
But that's also what it feels like.
Well, yes, absolutely. And I understand what they're really talking about is they're talking about it from a very straight perspective, which is that, isn't it nice to see a movie where we're not constantly, it's not about straight people being challenged with the notion of gayness and having to accept it and whatever, and that we're just watching people living their lives. They're not normal, though. They're like excessively handsome, and they live a West Hollywood life, and they all speak like they're on a TV sitcom.
Well, also, I think the things that I read about this movie, which made it kind of stand out a little bit, is that it wasn't one of those AIDS movies, that it wasn't dealing with the trauma of coming out, that it wasn't about AIDS. It was just simply about this group of friends living their lives. As self-obsessed as they are, and how tiring I found this movie watching it again at this particular point in my life. But at the same time, it was about just regular, quote unquote, average guys living life and going through and not being about, well, I don't know. I found it like there was still a lot about being gay, obviously, in the movie. Yes. And they had those, you know, it starts with those little definitions of what a newbie is,
right,
and the definition of meanwhile and what a gym bunny is. I thought, oh my God, like they're doing this for the straight people because a gay person would know what these are. So it felt right. kind of like very educational, but at the same time, I could see how they were trying to position this movie as these are just a group of five friends who love one another. And this is kind of just a glimpse of their lives in the year 2000 or whatever.
Yeah, because they're not average, but their ambitions are average, which is basically that they just want to be happy. You know, like it's not about yeah. people going on this great quest for something about self-acceptance or tolerance or dealing with AIDS or coming out. They're just romantic love lives.
And I feel like this movie works as some kind of a response because there were so many 20-something hangout movies in the late 90s.
Yeah.
So I feel like this movie is almost in conversation with something like Singles or something like Swingers or sure. Walking and Talking or Kicking and Screaming or even Friends.
Yes.
Like this movie would have had to be influenced by Friends, which started yes. in 95.
Yeah. Well, and also because it's directed by a guy whose main career was in television.
It was in TV, for sure.
And you can see that in the writing. You can
yeah,
see
that in but the I,
dialogue.
I quite enjoyed my rewatch of this.
Me too.
And I feel like that's mostly because of its low-key charm that, as you said, Brian, not a lot is at stake. Nobody has AIDS. The coming out to the parents is sort of handled off-screen. So all of those big dramatic moments don't filter into the action. And that's what I appreciated about this story.
It has a genuine good nature to it. And it's also written from the point of view of an actual gay man. And that makes a huge difference to other things that people would have been watching on this subject matter.
And I feel like there's a version of this movie that would have focused on Zach Braff's muscle friends that he goes into the bathroom stall with.
That happens very quickly. I mean, he says hi at the gym and the next thing you know, he's an addict.
He's doing poppers. Like, they're doing poppers in the washroom, and the next thing you know, he's an addict. Yes, I think that's what they were doing.
Are they doing poppers?
I thought it was harder drugs than that.
Oh, well, maybe. I could be wrong, but it just seemed like that particular storyline happened very quickly. Yeah. For me, it was more like kind of a – I got a Sex in the City kind of vibe from it. Like, all of your friends kind of fit. You have the ugly guy who rates himself as a 6 in a town of 11.
Yeah. Who was on Sex in the City, Yeah.
Yes, you have. Yes, exactly.
Oh my God, yes. Oh my God.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, though. I was really surprised when I went back to this movie. I was like, look at this cast. So you have Jennifer Coolidge in it, mm-hmm. who's playing like the hairdresser. And I was like, is that Jennifer Coolidge? And it's like, yes. There was, his name was Skipper, I think, from Sex and the City.
Yeah.
And there was Billy Porter in it. Like, it was pretty, like, when you look back on the cast and Dean Cain, obviously, but there were other people in it.
Timothy Oliphant.
And Justin.
Yeah, it was a pretty impressive cast overall for a movie, you know, that dealt around the, you know, gay lives and gay characters.
I think Matt McGrath is also gay in real life, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, he's a low profile guy and he's such a charmer. I mean,
better at the time because I'd seen him in a few other things.
Yeah, like, he doesn't do a lot of screen work, but he's in one of my absolute favorite hidden gems, The Imposters, with Stanley Tucci and Oliver Platt. Yeah, yeah. And he has such a delicious part in that.
Yeah.
And there was Justin Theroux.
I would say Theroux, but yeah.
Theroux? Okay.
It was
so yeah, gorgeous. So I mean it was when I went back to it, I was like, oh, I know that. Oh, I know that person. And it's almost like you have the 2023 reference for who these people are that I didn't have in 2000 when I was watching it.
The other thing that I appreciated about this movie is that even with this cast of ringers, outside of Zach Braff, and that's kind of excusable, nobody's pushing particularly hard to act gay or to stretch or to say, oh, look at me acting in this gay
world. I find it really hard to believe most of them as gay, particularly because they've all had such strong profiles since, and I can't really ignore that watching it 20 years later. Yeah. I don't remember it bothering me that much back then, even though Andrew Keegan in particular.
But Bill, do you have the same problem with going back and watching Jeffrey and watching Steven Weber?
No, not at all.
No.
Steven Weber can do no wrong. I also know that like in 2000, when this movie came out, very few of us had the same problem with that we would today of like straight men and like obviously straight men playing gay men. And my controversial take on that, which I think I've already expressed it on this show, is that we kind of did that to ourselves because gay men in the 70s and 80s really were vocally angry about any of our portrayals that portrayed us as like sissy Nellies because we're not
Addressed in this movie.
Right. And that's actually because they were usually portrayed in a negative way. And so the response to that in the 90s, in the like the post Melrose Place, Doug Savant 90s and 2000s, was to avoid that criticism by skewing as far away from that as possible, which usually meant erring on the side of straight acting, which means that that's the actor who is more likely to get the role.
But you still have, and again, this sort of opens up a conversation about tokenism, but you do have Billy Porter on the couch watching Joan Crawford movies to get over a breakup.
I'm watching one of my favorite Joan Crawford movies.
Which one? I didn't recognize it.
Yeah. Straight Jacket.
Okay.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I've seen it like three times. It's one of the movies that if you watch it, you see a lot of Volvaire inspiration in that movie.
But it's a compliment, though. Like I, you know, looking back on it now, I remember at the time being very flattered that a straight man would want to play a gay character. Like it validated, like it made me feel like I was more okay because the Dean Cains of the world were saying, correct, your life is worth me playing, which is totally
messed up. Don't get me wrong.
It totally is. But it's because we all knew that doing that was career suicide back then. And so, of course, we appreciated that people were doing that because we knew that if they didn't do it, no one was going to do it because no one was going to make the movie unless a star was in it.
Unless, as they say in the movie, unless you do it nobly as if you're dying of a...
Right.
You know.
Right. One of my favorite things about this movie, though, is the... I don't know that it's a central theme, but the whole subplot of Dean Cain having an affair with... Oh my God, I forgot how handsome Michael Bergen
was.
Jesus Christ, Baywatch. As the closeted movie star who is representing Take Your Pick. Like everyone's going to say Tom Cruise, but whoever. I love the running gag of Kip's not gay, he's married, and people are, you know, whatever. And then I love how Dean Cain has an affair with him, he gets screwed over by him, and then at the end, he's at that party, and someone's like, hey, I heard Kip is gay, and he goes, oh, Kip's not gay, he's married. And he's not just doing that because he's playing the Hollywood game of hush, hush. I appreciate that the what this film is saying about, you know, famous people wanting to be in the closet for the sake of their careers. If you want to do that, fine. This is a sacrifice you're making, but you don't get to be a part of the rest of it. If you want to have your secret sex in your trailer and whatever, go right ahead. But you don't get to be a part of all this other wonderful stuff. The friend group in West Hollywood, the playing baseball together, all that stuff. You have to miss out on that because of the fact that you're not being honest with the world about who you are. And I always like that about this movie. It does it in a not super judgmental, finger-pointy way.
I agree. I think the one thing that I found, though, I don't know how I felt about this, but there's a scene when they're all getting their hair cut by the same hairdresser, which is total bullshit. Like, what circle of gay friends all goes to the same hairdresser, right? But anyway, that's besides... And Jennifer Coolidge happens to be the hairdresser. And they're talking about, you know, there's this analogy of these monkeys that live in a tribe and they tear each other apart as sort of a means for survival. And they sort of have this thing where it's like, well, that's what we are as a friend group. Like, we tear each other apart. Like, it kind of made me sad a little bit that that was in there because the movie does not show that. Like, at no time did I, like, there's a couple of scenes where they, you know, the guy who becomes a drug addict, like criticize, like calls the other guy ugly or whatever. There's a few scenes where it's like,
would I ever be friends with someone again after they called me an ugly fuck? I don't know.
Well, listen, it's happened to me, but anyway, that's besides the point. But the bottom line is that
I'm sorry about that, Brian. I apologize for that before.
Whatever, it's Brian calling everyone an ugly fuck. Yeah. You didn't read my book, you're an ugly fuck. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to get into this, but anyway. Yeah. But the fact of the matter is they're kind of painted as this, why do gay men kind of like not get along? And there's all these quotes where it's like, you know, I love my friends, but I also hate the fact that they're in my life. Like these, this is my support system. And it did kind of feel like Boys in the Band a little bit, like harkening back to this idea of this dysfunctional circle of people who are constantly around one another. But I felt like it kind of fed into that mythology that gay men are really nasty towards one another when that's not really represented in the movie at all. Like if anything, there was a couple scenes, but for the most part, they're supportive.
Yeah. I think he's wanting to do something that references Boys in the Band that way without actually doing it.
Yeah. With sort of soft pedaling it. But what I appreciated about that was it very nicely, to me at least, touched on the sexual jealousy and the sexual competition that it comes when you're dealing with the same gender group of friends who are all attracted to the same gender or the same archetype. Was that, you could be friends, but there's always going to be this little undercurrent of going after the same guy or somebody getting laid more. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I felt
one of the funniest bits in the movie where he says, you know, we all want to be Cole and none of us wants to admit it, except Howie. Howie would probably admit it. And you cut to, I want to be Cole. Why can't I be Cole?
Perfect. Perfect.
I'm sorry, Daniel, I cut you off.
No, that's all I had to say.
As I said, this is written and directed by Greg Berlanti, who is probably better known for having directed Love, Simon. He directed the TV series Political Animals, the short-lived miniseries with Sigourney Weaver.
Which you saw, right?
Yes, I saw all of it, yeah.
And did you like it? I've never seen it.
I liked it well enough, but I'm not sorry that it didn't keep going. He produced the recently released Red, White, and Royal Blue, which is unofficially my film debut. and he's the writer-creator of Superman and Lois, the recent one, not the Dean Cain one. The Flash, You, Supergirl, Stargirl, Arrow, Brothers and Sisters, Jack and Bobby, Dawson's Creek is what he would have been most famous for at the time that he made this movie. That's why Carr Smith has a cameo as the umpire. And
is that a famous person who was in Dawson's Creek?
He's the gay kid on Dawson's Creek.
I've never seen Dawson's Creek.
He's very cute. He looks like a young Montgomery Clift. Yeah, I've only seen like one season of it. I was never into it when it was on. But anyway, Greg Berlanti's, I feel like his TV training is all over this movie in the way, as you said, Brian, like these characters are all very defined types. Not in a way that I find static or boring, but they're just very clearly defined as like, I am the hot guy. I am the bitter guy. I am the, I guess Howie is supposed to be Jewish. He refers to someone as a goy at one point.
But yeah, I caught that.
I don't know that Matt McGrath really pulls that off, but anyway. And then you also have
Bill, the Bradley Cooper as Leonard Bernstein trailer just dropped.
Only way that I want to fuck Bradley Cooper more than usual is for him to have an even bigger nose. I'm sorry to say it. It's not PC of me, but it's, yeah.
You want a Bradley Cooper with a nose of a Mandy Patinkin.
Absolutely. And you have a lot of like, and I don't mean this in a negative way, but the kind of dialogue you get on a TV show in this movie, that speech that Justin Theroux says about, I don't want to be your Rice-a-roni, the consolation prize on The Price is
Right. Which I did snicker at, which admittedly I did.
Oh, I don't have a problem with it. I just mean that I can tell that I'm watching a TV writer's work. And also the fact, as you said, the fact that they all go to the same hairdresser, like that's a premise around which a sort of a bit is built, which also feels like a TV show.
But I felt because this movie didn't aim to educate its audience about the dangers of too much sex, of being too promiscuous, right, of going down a drug hole, of going down a K-hole, I felt that ultimately its charm won me over.
Oh, yeah. I was actually surprised that I still liked it because lately a lot of people have been choosing movies for this show that I hadn't watched in ages and remembered liking and then revisited. And I'm like, oh, you've ruined this. You've ruined a good memory. Well, this one, I still liked it as well as I did back then, which is basically that I don't think it's in any way flawless.
Even those moments of dialogue that are a little bit too TV writery or a little bit too self-aware, still sort of got to me on some level.
Like, oh, absolutely. I like TV writing. I mean, I do it myself. So
and when Skipper says, "Oh, I'm attracted by association," that sort of gave me like a shock of recognition to hear a character say that.
Although I'd like to know more about his willingness to give his sperm to the two angriest lesbians that the world ever knew.
And the first time we see Neil Long, I'm assuming she's some sort of a business person. She's dressed like a sommelier at a fancy restaurant.
Right.
With that tie that's just a little bit too short.
A bad mood. She never softens for a second in this entire film. She's always
and don't give your sperm. Like, why? Like, why would you get into a lifelong relationship like with co-parenting a child?
Well, especially when it's your sister too, which is just weird.
Yeah.
And you don't entirely understand why she's so angry at Patrick this whole time.
No, but we have a long history in our show of doing movies where like gay men get a pass that gay women do not. Like lesbians are just the biggest, they're just born party poopers. At one point, they show up to talk to him and he says, "Oh, the world's only prompt lesbians." And I'm like, are lesbians famous for being late all the time?
I don't think they are though. Gay men are. I don't think lesbians are.
Yeah.
They're organized.
Absolutely. You know how Margaret Cho said, if you get rid of all the lesbians, no one will know sign language because they're the ones who teach us everything. everything. You know, like they're not late for anything. But it's also, I mean, if my sister asked me for my sperm, I would be like, okay, I'll think about it. If every time I saw her, she was mad at me for not having made a decision or when are you going to do this? I'd be like, you know what? We're not doing this because you need to step back. They pressure him super hard every time. They're
especially so the first time she asked for it, she's like, okay, they're in the car together and he's dropping her off. And she's like, okay, I need your sperm. Bye. Thanks for the lift.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And every time they talk to him about it, Neil Long is yelling at him. And I'd be like, I'm sorry, I'm not jizzing into a cup for you. You need to calm down.
And I know these are two tertiary characters. And I know that the movies maybe even today still haven't figured out how to deal with lesbians. But I never bought these two women as a couple.
No, we don't spend enough time with them. So this movie was made on a very, very low budget. $1 million is still very little money, even in 2000. And it was shot in 13 days, which is incredible. Because it does not feel that raggedy for something.
And it looks like a real movie.
It does. But I wonder how many pages they were getting through each day. And I also wonder, did he film stuff that he cut or did he write stuff that he cut and then he ended up with? Because I wonder if he originally wanted to do more to build up Zach Braff's drug addiction, for instance.
Because that comes and goes away very quickly.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's sort of by the end, because in the movie's third act, you have to deal with John Mahoney's death and Zach's drug addiction.
Yes.
And it's too much for an audience member to focus on coherently.
Well, did we need John Mahoney to die? Like, was that dramatically necessary?
Well, that was the thing. And my biggest issue with all of this is it's called the Broken Hearts Club, and it's billed as a romantic comedy. But really, I don't think it was a romantic comedy. It's kind of sells itself in a way and packages itself up in a way that I don't think was really true. But the thing that bothered me is like the whole baseball thing. Like, why was that in there? There was two scenes of them playing. Like, I get that they're all on a baseball team and that's kind of their connection. Yeah. But they're on a baseball, they're playing baseball twice in the movie, once against the firemen, once the other time against the seniors. They're miserable at it. Yeah. And, you know, the soundtrack, Sing a Song, which is that.
I love that needle drop.
But at the same time, it's like, why do they need to be on a baseball team? It just was pointless because you've got the restaurant. That's the connection, everybody.
Yeah.
Why do you just fill it with these gratuitous baseball scenes as a means of comedy, I guess.
Yeah.
But it was like, you don't need a baseball team in this movie in order for it to work. You just need these people as friends. And
I wondered about that too, because it doesn't facilitate some kind of movement of the plot to say that it's integral to, like, they're on that baseball team because he's forcing them to.
Yeah. The only thing plot development wise, I could think of something that came out of those baseball scenes was when Dean Cain picked up the closeted fireman catcher.
Right. Yeah. That's Carr Smith. Yeah. He also makes out with Andrew Keegan in that scene, and they both look like they're uncorking a bottle or something. It's like two straight guys who do not know what they are doing. It's like kissing girls, guys. Justin Theroux is the only straight guy who kisses convincingly in this movie at the end when he makes up with Matt McGrath, and he kisses him like he can't get enough of him. He's the only one.
I love Justin in this
Me
movie.
Me too.
I just thought that his performance was like so understated and just there was an endearing realness about his character.
And there always is. He's so, so talented and he's so hot, but I don't know that I believe him as gay.
I feel like he's on par with Jake Gyllenhaal in that respect, is that Justin Theroux is so ridiculously sexy, but he always retains this quality of being an everyman and being completely relatable no matter what he's doing.
Yes, but this, I don't know, something about his fashion style and the way he does his hair and everything. I've never known a gay guy who looked like that ever. And it's fine if
that. But at the same time, if in 2000 I was able to smoke pot and watch cartoons all day with Justin Theroux, I would be up on that.
Oh, no complaints. I mean, I didn't even know who he was when I saw this movie, and I was all about him when I saw it.
No, I guess the first time I remember him was when he had an arc on Six Feet Under, which I guess was maybe a couple of years after this.
Well, and I didn't recognize him from that. No, yeah, that was after this. When I saw this movie, I didn't recognize him from Romy and Michelle's high school reunion because he's got a big cowboy hat low over his face in that movie,
right,
so
right.
I didn't realize that was him. I'd like to know, speaking of Zach Braff's drug addiction, though, are you ever shirtless in a hospital bed?
That's a good point.
He is shirtless after, like, he's been admitted, he's been taken care of. Don't they put a robe on you? Or is he like, no, I'm sorry, I'm a West Hollywood gay. I cannot
wait. I guess. Also, now that we're on the subject, during a montage where he's hooking up with a gym bunny,
his when he does bicep curls, he has terrible form.
Yes.
He is using all sorts of momentum to do those bicep curls. Played
by another super straight guy, Christian Kane, who
I know from Angel.
Yeah, I was going to say everyone would know him from Angel.
Yeah.
They've all aged like straight guys, with the exception of Michael Bergen, actually, who still looks great.
You don't think Oliphant looks great?
He doesn't look as good as he did back then, to me. Although he hasn't bloated. Because you know how men always become either Mr. Furley or Russell Crowe? And he's not quite wizened, but yeah, he's okay. I don't know. He was never really my thing, although I do like him. I find him very amiable. And again, I don't believe him as a gay guy in this movie, but I also see it as somebody. I can see that there's like a good-natured actor who is paying attention to his gay friends and going out of his way to represent them faithfully.
And he's also not pushing too hard.
Yeah, but that's what I mean.
Which I appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's not about playing quote-unquote gay, because no one really knows, like, what does that even mean? It's about playing the character. Like, when Cher did Silkwood, she said, I just thought of the character's insecurity around her feelings about women. I didn't play a lesbian because I didn't know what that was. Meaning, I don't know what playing a lesbian means. But at the same time, these guys are all so straight that even Billy Porter comes off like he's pulled into butchness by them, you know? Billy Porter also moves in with them at one point because he's broken up with him, with his longtime partner who we never see. He moves in with them and he turns Timothy Oliphant's living room into like some kind of African safari fantasy.
There's a lot of leopard print. I noticed
a lot of animal prints, not just leopard. There's a zebra there. There's a whole bunch of things.
It reminded me, Brian, are you a Drag Race aficionado?
Yeah.
I can't remember if you are or not. You know, in All Stars 5, there was a challenge where the queens had to redecorate a hotel room and do a commercial about it.
Oh, I don't think I saw that episode.
It was like it was like Jujubee and Miss Cracker, and they did like a African safari themed hotel room that they had to shoot a terrible commercial for. And this is what this movie reminded me of when Billy Porter gave it his makeover.
Yeah,
Dean Cain gets a role in a movie with the Michael Bergen character. That is his name, right? From Baywatch.
Kip something.
Who wrote an entire book about his affair with Carolyn Bessette Kennedy, which, I mean, what a page turner that must be. But anyway, I might read that before I read your next book,
Brian. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
I forgot that they were together.
Yeah. Well, he says that they were still together after she married JFK Jr., which, given that he's like the TV version of JFK Jr., she clearly had a type. And also, she was a bit greedy. Leave the smoking hot guys. Share the wealth a little bit, Carolyn. I understand that you had like a perfect shade of blonde, a perfect, you know, straightener, but all at the same time.
Unfortunately, I can no longer think of JFK Jr. without thinking of that Seinfeld episode where Elaine rushes off to jerk off.
I mean, that was a very attractive man. But what was I going to say? Oh, yeah. So he gets a role in Michael Bergen's film, which when we see them shooting it, I understand that they're making light of Hollywood schlock, but it looks more like a TV show that he is on, like as a detective. He has a chauffeured car that picks him up to take him to set.
And also he had to go to a location shoot for an entire month with seven lines of dialogue.
Yeah, which can happen if it's an action film. And if you're filming like a rooftop chase, sometimes those can take like 2 weeks, especially back in the days when they spent more money on these things, which could happen. But I do feel that, but I agree that the details are murky because when he gets the part, it's like, oh, it's just a small part. So you're thinking, oh, it's a walk-on. He says that he was on the set for like 4 weeks. And that seems to be quite a big role, especially when you're doing that in a movie that you shot in too as one of the leads.
Could we just take a moment, if we could, just to talk about John Mahoney's drag act though in this, which
it bothers me
in a lot of ways, because
it was it was called Shall We Join the Ladies, which I first heard off of a Michael Feinstein album.
Sorry, Brian, continue.
But there's just fundamentals that really bothered me about this, because he gets changed in the kitchen, which I don't think any self-professed drag queen would do. Like, you don't get changed in the kitchen of your restaurant. He has an undershirt on and puts on like this kind of, you know, sleeveless dress where the undershirt is clearly visible. Right. There's a terrible blonde wig he puts on and like not a speck of makeup anywhere, and goes out, and the crowd's just like, oh, this is the best thing we've ever seen. I thought, this is terrible. This is a terrible drag show.
I mean, messy drag is definitely the point. I think to call him a drag queen is giving him much more credit than he deserves. I think it's one of those restaurants where it's famous for, on Friday nights, the owner puts on a wig and does a show. And the fact that it's a terrible disaster is the appeal for people.
It's part of the appeal. Like
a local charm. Yeah. Okay. I don't think that, I don't think we were being convinced that he was going in for anything super professional. But the undershirt bothers me every time I've seen this movie. The undershirt upsets me deeply, just on an aesthetic level.
And yet I'm the only person who gets annoyed by the fact that he was smoking a cigar while making food.
Yeah, welcome to 2000. Because if he put on like a crazy shirt under that dress, that would be fine. But the undershirt is a very upsetting look. I'm not into it at all. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys noticed also that the Weitz brothers are in this movie. The PA.
I caught that in the credits. Door,
and then the director of the movie is Paul and Chris Weitz, who...
And this would have been around the same time while they were making their own gay movie with Mike White, Chuck and Buck.
Yeah. And they are the sons of Academy Award nominated actress Susan Conner, who is still alive.
What was she nominated for?
Imitation of Life, my mom's favorite movie. She's the half black daughter. The black daughter who passes for white.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, who is not African-American, but is biracial in real life. And was wonderful in that film, which holds a very dear place in my heart. Because it's not just, I don't care that it's my mom's favorite movie, but it's the last movie that I watched with a very good friend of mine who passed away a few years ago. So.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. So they are in this room. I'm assuming they're friends with Greg Berlanti or something, and they came to help out.
I also appreciated the very 1990s vibe of not having the appropriate porn to jerk off to while you're lesbian sister your sperm.
Very and funny.
Although
I needed more. Howie is one of the more underdeveloped characters in this movie because he's very funny. That actor is so funny, and he can make a character who could be irritating very charming.
Completely.
But why is he so upset that he has to walk into a building holding porn? Like, I feel
because
like
he's because and I think that's where the Jewishness comes in, because every decisive action that this character takes is plagued with guilt and shame.
Right.
And keep in mind, he refers to it as porno. It wasn't porn.
He was born in.
Do you think that's porno or porn-o?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I'm going to say
dash. As a writer, what would you? Yeah.
I would do -o, the porno. It's a key differentiator.
Completely.
I would not be in the least bit bothered if this movie was adapted to like a short Netflix series today, but I wonder just how much would have to be changed from the simple things like when Timothy Oliphant is sort of mentoring young Andrew Keegan into the gay lifestyle. He says, you know, I have the same number as Cole, so, you know, call whenever you want, because they have a landline. Like, this is before cell phones, before, I mean, I had a cell phone in 2000, but I didn't, you know, it was before smartphones and apps and all that stuff. And like, how different would the script be written today? And also the way it treats drug culture, I mean, I feel like we're a lot more tolerant of people partying hard with drugs now, at least in terms of pop culture conversations, than we were in 2000, because it's an outright no-no in this film.
Yeah, I certainly do, because if you look at the big gay benchmark films from the past year, which were Bros and Fire Island, both of them, if they didn't involve direct heavy drug use, they at the very least alluded to people doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that it's not a problem unless it's a problem. While as in this movie, it's only bad people who do it.
I also wonder, to your point, Bill, like, so in the opening scene, you know, they've kind of done this, who could pass for straight, who could pass for gay. Yes. Yeah. Let's talk to the straight people that are in this store right now and ask them if you're a fag or not. And they're kind of like, oh yeah, you're definitely a fag or whatever. Like that, I don't think would fly obviously today.
No,
but that's such a representation. Like when I first came out and when I created a profile on gay.com, there was a category for mannerisms, whether you were butch, whether you could pass, whether you were effeminate or whether you were a flamer.
Yeah.
So when you message somebody, you knew what level of masculinity they fell under.
And then Daniel kept looking for the word shame and he couldn't find it. He's like, where's my category?
Completely.
Yeah.
So nothing's changed.
What was gay.com?
It was a chat site. You don't remember?
It? No, I don't remember that at all. And so I joined plenty of them. I'm not above all this.
So you would create a profile and you would log on to like Toronto West, Toronto East, Toronto North. You would log into a geek room, a muscle room. No, it was for years, right up until the dawn of smartphones.
They say fag on Will and Grace all the time too. Like there's a different cultural conversation about that word now, because in between the 80s and now we went through a period of, using it as a way to reclaim it, basically, because it was such a loaded word in the 80s and has become one again since.
But they also call themselves hag, though. Did you notice that? Yeah, like towards the end of the movie, there's this affectionate term. And I was like, I never called my friends hag. Like, I don't even, maybe that was a West Hollywood thing or whatever, but I don't ever remember that being a term other than fag hag, right? Which was a completely different connotation. Yeah. But hag, calling my gay friends hag, was never anything that I ever did. But
it's really, I love that part where they're asking all the people if they can tell he's gay. I think it's so funny when the woman's like, I don't know, fold your arms. Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, that's really funny. And I remember in the theater, I remember the biggest laughs that this film got was that sequence and the dating montage when he's dating all those crazy guys. I remember people were killing themselves.
That's for something that is overdone because we've seen any number of bad dating montages, I think it's a pretty credible one.
It is, and it's the one that I think of whenever we see them in other bad gay movies that we've done. I always rate it against, and I actually forgot how many things in this movie have stayed with me over the last 20 years, including my recently going through every season of Little House on the Prairie not long ago and remembering seeing a movie where someone talked about having had a crush on Albert in Little House on the Prairie. And I'd forgotten that it was in this movie that it's Howie who says that. But I also wonder how differently we would treat, you know, they do a bit of partner swapping in this movie and it's treated like high drama. The fact that they both, the two guys sleep with the young newbie. Played by Andrew Keegan,
who folds jeans at structure.
Yes, yeah. He's famous at this point for, it wasn't Gilmore Girls, it was another show that he was on, or was it?
I had no idea who this person was.
Yeah, he was on some teen show for like a couple seasons because when they were filming this movie, the girls approached him for his autograph, and then Timothy Olyphant was like, "I'll give you my autograph too." They're like, "We don't know who you are. We don't care." And I think it was it Dawson's Creek or was it another show that he was on? But anyway, but he sleeps with both. What was Timothy Olyphant's character's name?
Jason Jordan.
Oh, Dennis. Nope. Dennis. No, it is Dennis. I was right. Yeah, it's Dennis.
Okay.
Anyway, so the newbie sleeps with Dennis and Cole, and it's like a third act break between all of them when this happens. That the two guys are angry with each other over it. The other friends are very judgmental about it. And again, like, I wonder if we make this movie now, is that even going to happen? Or is everyone just going to get into threesomes and be in a polyamorous relationship or something like that?
Yes, no, maybe.
Yeah.
All of the above.
And also, does Zach Braff just always look like he's been up all night and hasn't showered? Or is that something he worked on for this film with that macaroni and cheese colored hair that he does?
I forgot because I remember this character so vividly, but I forgot that it was played by Zach Braff.
Zach Braff, for me, I'm not a huge fan of his. I also don't really dislike him. Like, I don't care about him. I always wonder, like, is there some creature that you feed after midnight and people like him and Dax Shepard pop off of them? Like, the two of them, I can never decide the pros and cons between the two of them who I like better.
Do you think they ever parent trap Kristen Bell?
Because they look similar, right?
They're the same.
Yeah. I think I'd rather have dinner with Dax Shepard. I think ultimately he'd probably be a lot more pleasant to be around.
Dax Shepard also looks like a little bit more fun.
Yeah.
Like I'm worried that Zach Braff just might take himself way too seriously for somebody with the career of Zach Braff.
Well, I mean, he made Garden State, so that's just like one thing I don't need to talk to him about, you know.
Yeah. And he also played the John Cusack role in the Broadway musical version of Bullets Over Broadway.
Did he?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
He's also in a Woody Allen movie as well. If you blink, you miss him. But he's their kid in Manhattan Murder Mystery.
No.
Yeah.
I didn't know he was a kid actor.
He's not a kid. He's like a university student in that film. But you barely see him in it. It's an early gig for him. Because when was Scrubs? Like late 90s?
No, I think it was after this. So maybe early
2000s. It was after this, yeah. Because I remember when it started, I remember knowing who he was from this movie. And then I love the League of Their Own ending, the budget League of Their Own ending with the Wall of Fame looking at the photos of baseball. I think, to your point, Brian, about baseball, I think the reason why they're on the baseball team is to tie into the, again, TV humor, like the irony of the fact that they're always like ironically showing their gay pride by comparing themselves to straight people by playing this game where they pretend to see who can pass for straight the most, whatever. And I think the baseball game is supposed to play into that as well. The joke of, isn't it funny that gay guys are playing baseball?
Yeah. Literally the first line of dialogue in this movie is Cameron Diaz is so hot.
Yeah.
when they're trying to pass each other off.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, the time, the cultural references that make this a time capsule, which obviously was not as obvious to me 23 years ago, are insane. Like, Andrew Keegan says his mom caught him masturbating to Antonio Sabato Jr.
But no, but an article. It was an article. Like, I was like, what? He was caught masturbating to Antonio Sabato's an article about him, not so much even the photos.
An interview?
Which, I mean, maybe it was a really interesting article. I don't know. I don't know if they've ever masturbated to an article before. But, you know, there's always hope for tomorrow, I guess.
Like, if there's a really sexy recipe you read, like, what would this article be?
He's like, what's next? What's on your night table? What are you reading, Antonio? And it's like, oh...
Antonio's another one who went bad, by the way. Speaking of Dean Cain, Antonio's another one who went to
the He's like a a complete like libertarian or whatever.
So when the Trumpists need their celebrity report, endorsements, it's Dean Cain, Mary Hart, Scott Baio, Antonio Sabato Jr.
I didn't know Mary Hart as well.
Yeah.
Really? Mary Hart?
She they upped her premiums on her legs. And she's like, this is an unfair country. Yeah, it's a common trajectory, I find, with a certain kind of, like, I've seen it a lot. There's a lot of gay porn stars. There's a lot of personal trainers. These guys who are, like, golden gods when they are young and fit. Something about doing a job where you are convinced that everything relies on your ability and your effort that makes you believe in, like, complete, you know, no social support systems, complete independence. And I'm not surprised to find all these guys who were, you know, Calvin Klein models or whatever, that turn to a sort of obsession with seeing all liberals as being whiners who don't want to, you know, work for a living, and that they see themselves as fighting for every man for himself, basically. Even though in reality, none of us can do anything without everybody else. Like, we do all need each other, but yeah. So I'm never shocked by it.
It's a power thing though, too, because I think like in the Dean Cains of the world, right? Yeah. Where you have somebody who sort of peaks at, I don't know, let's say 25, 30, yeah. And then they lose their power. Like, they lose that, whatever it was that they had.
Yeah.
It must be very difficult for them to process that. And I'm sure that they find reasons, or there's some anger or resentment about it, that you whatever appealed to other people about you, you have lost, you know, for rightly or wrongly.
It wasn't something they actually earned. Like, they were, people wanted them because they were super hot, and being super hot isn't necessarily something other than the fact that I'm sure they watched what they ate and they worked out, but like, that's something that was given to them. It came very naturally to them. And so they don't realize what the nature is of that power. So of course, when it's gone, they've decided that the whole world is against them, that everything is unfair. And I'm not surprised that they turn to something extreme to do something about it.
You know? Yeah. And your whole identity is built on that too, right? It's built on your attractiveness, it's your hotness or whatever. It's people wanting you. That's how you define yourself. And when that stops, how do you define yourself? Like, you have to go out and find a new identity.
Not just wanting you, but having an investment in saying yes to you as well. And when that goes away, of course you're going to, you know, anyway. Highly philosophical conversation for inspired by this one, but I think about that a lot. I think about that when I do watch, like, the rare time that I'm gonna watch Dean Cain in something, or remembering Antonio Sabato.
Dean Cain was just the love interest in Lady Dynamite, which is such a wonderful the Maria Bamford show.
Well, apparently, he's a lovely guy. He's apparently a wonderful actor. I mean, he's a wonderful person to work with. I don't think he's a particularly good actor, but he's not bad either. But Sabato's Calvin Klein campaign, I have to say, was a smoking hot campaign. The Mark Wahlberg one never did anything for me, but Sabato's, I remember really capturing my imagination when I would see it on the subway or whatever.
I also rushed home in time for General Hospital.
Yeah.
To see him on General Hospital. So hot.
I don't remember Michael Bergen being a Calvin Klein model, although apparently he was.
I remember him being on the cover of a lot of early aughts fitness magazines.
Yeah, and he was on Baywatch. That's what he's most famous for.
Yeah.
And then if you look at him up now, he is a full silver fox. He has aged very beautifully.
Good for him.
Happily married. Anyway. Also, I love that all of these guys' conversations are things that Greg texts me at 7 a.m. Who would you kick out of bed? Grimace or the Hamburglar?
No, theirs was Mike Wallace or Morley Safer.
He does say Grimace or the Hamburglar as well.
He does say that, yes.
Which, how do you kick Grimace out of bed? How do you fit Grimace into your bed?
But at the same time, I think Grimace would be happier and more responsive to having sex with somebody.
Yeah, but he's
I think there's something a little bit impersonal about having sex with a Hamburglar.
No, the Hamburglar. No,
Hamburglar is all about the mask.
Yeah.
Hamburglar's got the prison uniform on. Yeah, he's got the mask. There's a bit of mystery. There's sort of that bad boy vibe. Like, I don't think Grimace would be very exciting at all.
He's for sure going down on you for hours.
I disagree because I think the Hamburglar would be doing that to be compensating for something that would be coming up in the bedroom.
Yes, but that's hot. Being grateful in bed is not hot, as much as we all are. Yeah. But Grimace is grateful, and I don't think it's sexy to be around. No.
No.
So what's your So where do you come down on Mike Wallace versus Morley Safer?
I can't. I think Mike Wallace for sure. I think he was actually.
I think Mike Wallace for sure. Yeah. With smoking while it happens. Like, I think that's sort of a turn on. He's got to have a cigarette out of his mouth when we get it on.
Yeah,
for sure.
I mean, as if he's interviewing like Richard Nixon or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
What we actually want is Leslie Stahl, but we'll settle for Mike Wallace.
It's like the Jeffrey line. What's your sexual fantasy? Jackie Onassis to see the apartment.
Well, I just kind of wonder now, was it like, I realize we're here to talk about bad gay movies, but maybe this wasn't such a bad gay movie after all. Maybe
I don't think it was bad at all. Kind
of, no, I don't think it's bad
it
at all.
It has kind of worn its, maintained its charm over the years in spite of whatever its obvious flaws are, but it's kind of held up.
It's dated better than I thought it was, in that whatever I found flawed about it at the time is still pretty much the same now. Like, I don't feel that it's an eyesore in retrospect.
Absolutely not. I think it's an adorable time capsule. One of the things that I want to bring up is I want to try to track Celine Dion's status as a gay icon, because when Billy Porter gets broken up with, he's at the party and he's like, I need to listen to Bette. I need to listen to Barbara. Yes. I need to listen to Judy. And somebody says, oh, here's a Celine Dion CD. And he says, no Celine Dion. Absolutely not.
Because everyone still has My Heart Will Go On playing day and night. And it's a cheesy ass song. And I think
and like Power of Love. So this is before Celine Dion sort of claimed that status as a gay icon.
Because it's why I never got into her, because it was all like cheesy ballads that straight couples like to dance to at high school dances. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't going to take part in any of that. I was too cool. I was too cool to be loved and have a girlfriend.
But there's a beautiful shock of recognition when somebody digs up the Beaches soundtrack.
Oh, yes. And he says, what track does he ask for? Do you remember?
No, tell me.
He says track 4, which, if I am not mistaken, is I think it's going to rain today.
Human kindness is overflowing.
A Randy Newman song. Yeah. He doesn't need a Randy Newman song, because that's what he feels like listening to in his breakup. I did find that joke, that running joke, funny, of him always starting his sentences with, as a person in a long term relationship, can I just tell you? And he goes, is there any sentence you don't begin with? As a person in a long-term relationship?
The answer is no.
One thing that disturbed me a little bit, speaking of music, was when there's that scene where the Timmy Oliphant character is getting it on with the hot guy at his house party. Wants to listen to the Carpenters as mood music. And it has never crossed my mind to listen to Top of the World or like any of that music to kind of get, like, if you were getting it on with somebody, like, hold on, let me put on the Carpenters. And it's like, no, it's time to go, get me out of here. I just felt like that was a little, I'm not all about that.
It'll make me feel fat, first of all, if you start playing the Carpenters. I'm starting to get very self-conscious about my weight.
You know what else I could have done without was the slow down melancholy minor key cover of Close to You that we got towards the end of the movie.
Well, it's all covers in this movie because they can't afford the
real
version.
Which is fine, but I don't think Close to You lends itself to any sort of emotional depth for a slowdown cover.
Well, it's also, the Carpenters is an interesting choice because that's not his era. And so you need more information. Like, is it just because it's Greg Berlanti's and he's a bit older or what? Because a guy his age, who's around my age at the time, if he's into the Carpenters, it's because like his parents loved it or something. It speaks to a bit of a character quirk, which is not a way that the Timothy Olive that Dennis is being presented as. He is the center of the group, so he's a little bit more soulful and thoughtful. You know, at the end, the irony of it being a romantic comedy is that he decides to find himself and go to Europe to pursue his photography or whatever. But I don't know that there's enough information to justify why the Carpenters, and also why you're so upset that this super hot, super straight guy in his J. Crew sweater doesn't know who the Carpenters are. Like, what do you care that he doesn't know who the Carpenters are? Like, why are you being such a dick to him when you decide now that you no longer want to do soulless hookups and you want more, that's okay. But like, why are you making it his fault? Mm-hmm. There's a little bit missing there. I hate it when people want to put on music during sex. I find it distracting and it puts my brain in a loop, and it drives me absolutely up the wall.
It also sets up some kind of expectations that I would be worried about not fulfilling if it's like, oh, this is the song I want to fuck you to.
I find it distracting. I find it completely.
Top of the world. Let's be honest. The Carpenters is the tough act to follow, right?
Well, especially if it's a song I want to sing along to, it's particularly.
Yeah, Brian, you say top of the world. I say I'd like to teach the world to sing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Or close to you. That's what, you know.
Sure. Close to you. Yeah. Yes,
it's also not hot. Like, Carpenters is not hot music.
I've never, ever thought the Carpenters were even remotely romantic or sexy or anything.
No, I take it all back. I would fuck to Superstar. I would fuck to Don't You Remember You Told Me Love Me.
I would fuck to the Bette Midler version of that, though. Yeah.
But mainly I was just, you know, listen, you watch these movies sometimes, and you know, for myself, I watched it alone, and I sometimes don't know how I feel about it, because you're bringing a lot of baggage when you see these movies too, right? It has to be a certain thing. It has to hit all the notes right. It has to sort of fill all the pockets that you felt were missing up until now. So I bring a lot of baggage to these gay movies, right? Yeah. And I try to unshackle a little bit with myself, all my issues, and as I'm watching it, to say, don't be overly critical of it, just accept it for what it is.
Yes.
But it's interesting to always talk to other people, especially gay men about movies about gay men, because it's like, how I don't sometimes know how to feel about it. Like, it's kind of I don't know how to respond to it sometimes.
Yeah, but that's the response sometimes. And it's also important to chart like where it lands. Critical doesn't have to mean negative, right? Like, that's not actually the meaning of that word. It's a matter of like marking the effect that it has.
And I think for Broken Hearts Club, we can pick apart any number of choices, any number of things that are dated, any number of performances that don't quite work. Yeah. But I was just, I think there's a charm, and I think there's an honesty and a sincerity to this that also really sort of took me off guard.
We have watched a lot of movies written by people who hate their characters, particularly when they are writing about hot guys fucking in West Hollywood. And the movies are always written by people who are really angry that they don't get to be a part of that world.
And there are any number of people in this movies who don't find love, who don't find sex, who don't find anything reciprocal, but they don't end the movie like the character Skipper plays, Patrick. He doesn't end the movie in a particularly angry or bitter state, even though he's not getting what he needs.
He's just getting on
sexually.
And it's because Berlanti doesn't hate any of these people. It's particularly notable. Like, I actually like the character that Dean Cain plays of Cole, because he's not sorry about the fact that he's hot and everybody wants him and that he enjoys it. And he's not a dick about it either. He's just like, this is the card I've been dealt, and I play it.
And you could also kind of figure out where that character fits into this friendship circle.
Absolutely, yeah. And Berlanti doesn't punish him for the fact that he is quote unquote luckier than them. There is a charm of it. The only thing I'd say is a shame about this movie is that I probably did watch it at the time thinking, you know, this movie is good in many ways and it has its flaws, but it's the result of it being made on a super, super low budget, which is what's going to happen when you make this movie about gay men, and that when it's about straight people, it's usually a big studio release. And this movie hopefully will lead to, in the future, bigger, more expensive, better made movies like it. But actually, in retrospect, it's actually the best of so many, like everything else we've watched.
Yeah.
You know, that promise was not fulfilled, basically, which is that everybody else who made this movie, also on a low budget, whatever, made something way worse. So,
yeah,
you know, and then when we finally do get to Bros 22 years later, I don't know, I already talked about that movie on this show, but like, it's not a movie that I think of as being a failure or worthless, but there's a lot about it that I wish was more, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, for sure.
Yeah. I should also point out this movie won the GLAAD Media Award that year for the Outstanding Film Limited Release, which is a big deal. They give out 2 film awards every year, and for a major film and an independent film. And it's a pretty big deal that it won that. Brian, having you on was such a pleasure. We will not wait so long to do it again.
Invite me back anytime. I'm always willing to discuss and dissect, you know, bad gay movie, so I'm here for this.
Absolutely, and I did not even get to talk your ear off about what's going on in the Toronto Public Library these days, because that's also
Oh, it's never a dull moment at the library. I will say that much. People always think that the library is this kind of quaint, quiet little place where people just sit in corners and read, but it's a very bustling, busy place. And I think
I'm at mine every Saturday. Yeah. I'm a super user of the Toronto Public Library.
Okay, perfect.
And I have told you this before. It is the best use of city resources, basically. Our tax dollars have never gone further and been more effectively used than they are in the
Toronto Public agree Library more.
System. It is truly, truly Thank marvelous. You. Yeah. And
appreciate that. Thank you.
And I'm currently holding on to a DVD that I have to return to the library tomorrow with a note on it saying that they put a sticker on the wrong side of the disc and ruined it. But
for the most part, I have no
complaints. Yeah.
I just got the Terrence McNally biography from the Toronto Public Library, which I'm about to start tomorrow.
Yeah. No, we are unmatched. So thank you for your service.
Thank you for your service.
Yeah. Oh, happy to be of service.
And all the best to you for future for your writing as well. You have accomplished so much, and I know you will accomplish so much more. Thank you for doing this. Thank you for joining us. And this is what I'm trying to remember. Please tell our listeners where they can find you, follow you, all that stuff.
You can check out my author site, which is brian-francis.com, or my Wikipedia page.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Is there anything wrong on it? Is there any incorrect information, like you dated Martha Stewart or something like that?
No, there's no. Nothing.
That happened, Bill. That is not incorrect.
That did happen. Yeah. No, there was nothing incorrect on it. And it's good to know, because I think with Wikipedia, you need to know people who know how to, like, they're authorized editors, right?
Yes,
so like I know somebody that can do it. So if I ever notice anything on there or whatever, I'm able to just say, hey, can you make these edits to it? Which is nice to know somebody who can do that.
And Brian recently published a ranking of macaroni and cheese packages that was a personal revelation to me.
That's incredible.
Yes. Boxed macaroni and cheese. Which one was the best? 14 different brands I tried. And it was a dark night, but I made it through and declared a winner. Yeah, that's on my author site too.
Oh, okay. So I can't ask now. I have to log in to find out.
Do you want to know who the winner was?
I'm dying to know.
The winner was Annie's, actually, and I was very pleased by that because it's organic, and I just thought they were the best, and there are so many shitty brands of macaroni and cheese out there. It was truly, like, the one that disappointed me the most was Velveeta in shells, the one where the Velveeta comes like in a pack. It was disgusting. Yeah, yeah, I couldn't believe that it was as bad as it was.
Chemical cheese compound.
It was awful.
And I was personally surprised because I thought that President's Choice White Cheddar was going to do a lot better than it did.
My sister is going to become your best friend, Brian, because she brings me Annie's all the time. And I'm like, what is this stuff? And she goes, no, you have to. This is way better than Kraft Dinner. So you have elevated yourself in this household.
It really is. It's expensive. Like, you can get Kraft Dinner for like 79 cents or 99 cents at No Frills. Annie's is like $3.99, but it's worth it. Splurge. Get yourself the good macaroni and cheese and just treat yourself, because you deserve it. You deserve good macaroni and cheese.
You heard the man.
You deserve to eat 500 calories per spoonful. Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah, pretty much.
You might as well be like eating scoops of ice cream in your bowl. That's so wonderful. Okay, well, thank you for that. Daniel, tell our listeners where they can find and follow you.
You can find me on Instagram at KrolikD, KrolikD, or give us a follow at Gay4Pay Productions.
Absolutely. You won't find any information about his podcasting on his Wikipedia page, because apparently that aspect of his life is not important enough to include. So, Brian, if you want to tell your super user friend to,
I didn't even have a Wikipedia page until 5 seconds ago.
Do you know that we have an IMDb page because of this podcast?
Yeah, podcasts are now on IMDb.
Yeah, and we're on there. Yeah, it's so strange. Awesome. Yeah, I didn't do anything for it. It all happened. All right, and then, of course, you can find me on Instagram at my name, Bill Antoniou, and, of course, follow this podcast on Instagram, Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter. Just look up Bad Gay Movies. We do take donations at PayPal. You can enter the email address badgaymovies2013@gmail.com. Send us your recommendations of films we should do in the future, because I am still looking to pick themes for future episodes. thank you guys again for this, and see you all later.
Yay!
Thank you.